Philosophy of language studies the nature of meaning, how words, how sentences mean what they do, what it is for them to have meaning, how they relate to the world. And one of the biggest difficulties is knowing where to start this kind of inquiry. Every sort of inquiry has to start somewhere. You have to make some assumptions, otherwise you could never get an inquiry going. There are going to be some things that you simply presuppose and don't question. But in the case of a subject like the nature of language and its relation to the world, the issues seem to be so deep, so fundamental, that one hesitates to start anywhere because one hesitates to make any assumptions at all. It seems that that can't be justified in this particular case. But then one would never get going. So one has to choose a starting point of some sort, but in the knowledge that one may at a later stage want to come back and revise that starting point. That it's really just a way of getting the inquiry going, and it may not have any ultimate significance. However, having said that, the first topic in this course in philosophy of language is the context principle, and I haven't chosen that arbitrarily. I've chosen it because it seems to me that this is a good starting point, in the sense that thinking about the context principle, about what it means and what its significance is a way of getting to the heart of the nature of language fairly quickly. Now, why do I say that? Well, first of all, we need a statement of the context principle. And the version that philosophers usually work with nowadays is the version formulated by Frege, who was, or is generally regarded as having been, the founder of modern analytic philosophy. And in his work, The Foundations of Arithmetic, he formulated the principle that a word only has meaning in the context of a sentence. He wasn't the first person to formulate this principle or something like it, as we'll see shortly, because we'll also look at Jeremy Bentham's treatment of that principle or a very similar principle. Now, he formulated this principle in his work, The Foundations of Arithmetic. But he doesn't actually say very much about it in that work. He regards it as a parameter of the investigation, as a principle that has to be respected. But he doesn't tell us very much about what he thinks it really involves. And this is where Bentham, who I mentioned a moment ago, comes in handy, because in his essay on language, he has a section which goes into some detail on why something like a context principle is desirable. And his reasoning is that it doesn't make sense to suppose that words, as it were, initially function on their own as isolated signs, and then only afterwards, as it were, get put together into sentences. And he's here attacking a long tradition of theorizing about language, going back to Aristotle. From Aristotle onwards, through the medieval period, through the early modern period, there were many discussions of treatises on language, and they tended to proceed bottom up in the sense that they dealt with words first, and then they only came to sentences later. Now, they were motivated partly by a good thought, and it's one we're going to be saying a great deal more about, namely that words are the building blocks of sentences, right? This is what goes under the name of the principle of compositionality, and that's a principle we're going to be talking about in due course. So there's a good thought there, which is that sentences are made up of words, and in that sense, there must be some sense in which words come first. But what Bentham argues is that if you think of words in terms of their functions, and words have functions, then these functions are endowed by the role that words play in sentences. So it would be absurd to suppose, says Bentham, and I've quoted the passage about halfway down page 2 of my book, which is on the online for you on the Canvas site. He imagines a situation in which words were invented first in the history of language, so going back a long way, and then after a long period where people used individual isolated words, some very clever person devised a way of putting the words together to form sentences. And the idea is that that is an absurd hypothesis. Bentham's thought is that it can't possibly be like that or have been like that. The reason why that is so is as I've hinted, that words have a functionality. A word has a function. Or to put it in a slightly more technical way, words have syntactic properties. That's to say, they have ways of combining with other words. And words don't all have the same syntactic properties. There are nouns, there are verbs, there are adverbs, and so on. And these categories of word all have different syntactic properties. And indeed, there are subcategories within a given category. There are syntactic subcategories as well. A noun, like cat, for example, behaves very differently from a conjunction like if, or a verb like dig. And these syntactic properties of words are part of their nature. They're not, as it were, an adventitious add-on. They're not something that comes afterwards as an afterthought. It's not as though the word existed first with its full meaning, and then its syntax came along or was given to it at a later stage. That's in effect the scenario that Bentham is imagining and which he's ridiculing, in which you have a bunch of words that are that hang loose from one another, that are entirely separate, and don't form any kind of system or network at this early stage. And then this clever inventor decides that there's a way of putting these words together to give them a syntax, to give them sentential properties, but that is something essentially added on to words. It's not part of their essence. So as I say, that's the position that Bentham is making fun of. And the way he does it, as we've said, is that he imagines a very clever person inventing syntax for words that are already, as it were, fully formed. Bentham's point, I think, is easiest to see. If you don't think it's obvious, I think it's easiest to see if you take parts of speech like conjunctions, like the word if, for example. It seems fairly evident that in that case, You couldn't have the word if existing on its own with its full meaning, as it were, and then at a later stage somebody devises a way of putting it into sentences together with other words. It seems obvious that the word if is a conjunction essentially. It has a certain function, and that is the way it functions in conditional sentences, as we call them. So it's part of its very essence to jostle with other words in sentences and to affect and be affected by those other words. It's essentially a networker, if you like, the word if. And it seems pretty obvious in the case of conjunctions that is true, that they are words whose function is to combine with other words to form whole sentences. Some people have queried whether this applies to all words, and I've given you an example of that on page 3, where I've quoted a bit of Geech, who says, and I'll read the quote, "An act of naming is, of course, not an assertion. It may be correct or incorrect, but not, strictly speaking, true or false. It does, however, express a complete thought, as grammarians say about sentences. It has a sort of independent sense. Naturally, the sense of a name used in this way is not independent of the language or of the situation that makes such use appropriate, but it is independent of any verbal context expressed or understood. It is not like the sense of a fragmentary expression that answers a spoken or unspoken question." So there Geech is saying that names do have a certain independence from the sentence. And it is, of course, tempting to think this. You know, whereas if somebody just utters the word if in isolation and doesn't go on to complete the sentence, as it were, and there's no sentence implied, it just comes out of the blue and that's it. In that sort of scenario, we can make nothing of it. It wouldn't make any sense to us. What if this person utters a name instead? Okay, so suppose I just say out of the blue, "The Pope." Have I said anything? Have I uttered a complete thought? Well, Geech is inclined to say yes to that. It seems to me, however, I mean, this is actually the question I've asked you for discussion in the first seminar to decide whether he's right about this or whether Bentham is right. Bentham would say, and in fact does say, no, even proper names require a context to make sense. If I just say the word John, that on its own makes no sense. You can utter the word, Bentham says, as a command. I think, if I remember rightly, the scenario he has in mind is his son is called John and he's calling his son to him, he's summoning him. So he says, "John." And there the sense is, "I would like you to come here," or "John, please come here." It's something like that. So he's not simply naming his son. If you ask, you know, if he says John and you say to Bentham, "What do you mean, John? What are you doing with that word?" He wouldn't reply, "Oh, I didn't mean anything. I just meant John. That's all I meant. I was just uttering the name." No, he would say, and he does say, in fact, in the essay, "I mean something like, John, come here. I summon you," something like that. I mean it as a command which can be expressed in the form of a sentence. Another example would be, of a similar nature, would be name badges worn at conferences. When you go to a conference, you get given a badge with your name on it. And, so, you know, you don't find people, when I wear a little label saying Richard Gaskin, I don't normally find, probably will now, but hitherto I haven't normally found that people come up to me, stare at the name and say, yeah, Richard Gaskin, what of it? That's a name. What about it? No, they know that in effect I'm asserting, there's an implicit act of assertion there. And I'm saying, I am Richard Gaskin. That is my name. The whole sentence has not been written out. It's not necessary because it's understood, but it is implicit. It is there in the background. You're not simply performing an act of naming. And I think, although, yeah, I haven't put all of Geech's examples in the quote, but if you look at the original article, which I've taken the quote from, you'll see that he has several examples of names which he thinks are self-standing. Name badges worn at conference is one of them. Another one is, say, the word poison on a label on a bottle. And again, Geech wants to say, well, there's a sense in which that use of the word poison is independent of sentences. It does express a complete thought at a prior stage, as it were, to being fitted into sentences. Now, of course, it's quite true that you might say it expresses it has a meaning independently of any given sentence. That seems a reasonable point to make. But of course, as you see from the quote, Geech wants to go further than that. He doesn't merely want to say that the word poison on a bottle doesn't presuppose any particular sentence. He wants to say that it has a meaning independently of any sentence at all. And that is the bit which I would want to query. It seems to me that some sort of sentence is presupposed, not necessarily a particular one to the exclusion of others. There are several possible candidates. Another of Geech's examples is the boy who cried wolf, right? Or somebody shouting fire. And again, I think the same point applies. Somebody who yells out fire isn't simply naming that kind of thing. They're not simply referring to fire. That person is implicitly saying something sentential, namely, there is a fire in the building, or something like that. Again, there needn't be a unique sentence that captures the sense of that utterance, but some such sentence will convey the meaning of that word as uttered in that context. So it seems to me that Geech is wrong about that point. Names are subject to the context principle just as much as other words. They get their meaning, their whole meaning, from their functionality in sentences. So in other words, as Geech seems to be saying in that passage, there isn't a sense in which, it's not the case that a name expresses a complete thought before you arrive at its syntax, as it were, before you arrive at any way it might figure in sentences along with other words. That those combinatorial properties of the word, the way it combines with other words, its syntax, that's part of its very essence, part of its meaning, all the way down. And this point was made by Wittgenstein in the early sections of the Philosophical Investigations. In several passages, I've quoted one of them on pages 2 to 3. Again, I'll read out this passage. I think it's section 49. Only someone who already knows how to do something with it can significantly ask after a name. Naming is not so far a move in the language game, any more than putting a piece in its place on the board is a move in chess. We may say nothing has so far been done when a thing has been named. It has not even got a name, except in the language game. This was what Frege meant too, when he said that a word had meaning only as part of a sentence. Okay, so The context principle says that words are made for sentences. They get their purpose and their point from the way they figure in sentences. That's essential to their meaning. They don't have meaning in isolation. But of course, as we've noticed in passing, you do quite often get utterances of single words. We consider the Bentham example, John, the Geech examples, fire, poison, wolf. And what I said about those was that they do presuppose a sentential context. It's not explicit, but it is there to be understood, and that you have to understand it in order to understand the utterance of the single word. If you, as I said, just to repeat the point, if you thought that when somebody shouted fire, all that person was doing was referring to fire, just making a reference, you wouldn't understand that utterance. You've got to take the utterance as an implicit statement that there is fire somewhere nearby. And that is to put it in the form of a sentence. So it seems to me that the context principle is correct in telling us that words derive their function, their meaning, and their point from the way they figure in sentences. However, there's an obvious difficulty that you may want to raise here, you may have thought of raising, and people do raise, which is that you might say, well, Geech's examples, somebody shouting fire or wolf or putting poison on a bottle, are perhaps unfortunately chosen. They're not the strongest examples he could have selected from his own point of view. Why didn't he, for example, think about the development of language? Why didn't he think about human language in its very early stages? Because there, of course, we have to rely a great deal on conjecture. There's a great deal we don't know about the origin of language. In fact, what we don't know is greatly exceeds what we do know, probably. But it does seem fairly plausible that sentences developed historically out of individual words, so that sentences comprising several words were not the first things to be uttered. And the reason why people find this plausible is that they make the assumption, but it is a plausible assumption, I think, that human language developed out of primitive animal cries. So if we look at the non-human animal world, we can see that a whole range of animals emit noises which have some kind of significance. So birds, for example, have warning calls. And there is obviously some kind of communication going on when one bird warns the other members of the flock that a predator is near, and they all fly off. It seems as quite reasonable to say that information has been transferred. An act of communication has indeed taken place. And on the other hand, on the other side of the coin, this is what you might have been wanting to say to Bentham at when I quoted the earlier passage. It's all very well to say that it would be absurd to imagine that a lot of isolated words were dotted around the landscape, as it were, and then some very clever person discovered how to put them into sentences. But chronologically, it must be the case that words came first and sentences later, or it couldn't be the case that sentences, as it were, and words all sprang into existence at once. That seems very implausible. I mean, that would be an extraordinary leap of evolutionary development for sentences to, as it were, suddenly emerge fully formed. And it's, you know, we don't have any other examples of that kind of extraordinary jump, so as to believe that it could really have happened. And it seems much more, I mean, this is really an empirical argument, and you might say it's logically possible for a species to suddenly mutate, as it were, in such a way that it's now able to come out with and understand whole sentences, whereas before it was simply dumb. But no serious researcher into the origins of language believes that that is what happened. Much the most plausible hypothesis from an empirical point of view, and from I think as well from the point of view of general a priori considerations, is that we know that human beings evolved from animals. We know that many animals, and certainly the higher animals from which we evolved, are capable of making noises that have some kind of significance and affect some kind of communication. So that it seems very likely that we started off in that way as well. We, when I say we, I mean Homo sapiens, human beings. We would have, as it were, inherited from our ape ancestors the ability to utter individual noises that have some kind of significance, whether as warning or as a threat or as an invitation or whatever. And that, yes, of course, Bentham's idea that a lot of individual words like cat and dog and sun and hill and tree could have been around fully formed before anyone thought of putting them into sentences. That does seem absurd. But it must be the case that gradually isolated noises coalesced into larger units. It must have been the case that you started off with a bunch of separate noises, like bird calls, but that the higher animals, as they evolved, developed the ability to start putting noises together. So first of all, the crucial, of course, move is from one to two. Once you've effected that, the rest is, as it were, plain sailing. Once you've got a two-word sentence, you've got a sentence, you've got syntax. The words must be related in some way. So that's the crucial step. And actually, we can, by studying the animal world, and surprisingly, by studying bird calls, we can gain some kind of inkling as to how that might have happened. There's an interesting, I've referred in the passage of the book that I'm asking you to read, around page, I think, four, I've talked about some of James Herford's views. And he has written two very big books on the origins of language and grammar. I don't suggest that you read them, although you might follow up the reference I'm about to give you, which is to a passage in which he talks about the song of the chaffinch. I don't know if any of you are bird watchers or interested in birds. I am. I hope when I say the word chaffinch, you can associate some mental image with that and conjure up a picture of that bird. The chaffinch has a rather uninteresting song. If you're a bird watcher, you won't be terribly interested in its song, I can tell you. But from our current perspective, it is very interesting because it seems to exhibit a very primitive form of syntax as follows. The chaffinch's song falls into two parts. There's an initial bit, which is just called the song, confusingly, and then there's what's called the trill, like a musical trill. And so the whole song consists of song plus trill. And the interesting thing about the chaffinch is that it seems to be the case, according to the evidence, that the length of the whole performance is fairly constant. I think it's about, I'm not sure what it is, but it's a matter of several seconds. let's say 5 seconds. I'm not sure if that's accurate, but let's just say, for sake of illustration, that the performance as a whole should last 5 seconds, and generally does. But within that overarching frame, the two bits can have different lengths. But if so the song could be 4 seconds long and the trill 1 second, or the song could be 2 seconds long and the trill 3 seconds. I'm probably exaggerating the extent to which the variation occurs. But anyway, there is definite variation while maintaining the overall length of the performance. And so what that means is that in some way the chaffinch is operating with a very primitive syntax, because the two parts of the song are influencing and affecting each other. If the song only lasts for 2 seconds, then the trill has to last for three. Right, so there's a relation of determining going on between different parts of the song. Certainly in that forwards direction. Whether it would work in the reverse direction, I don't know. It begins to sound a bit too sophisticated if you say something like, I mean, you know, it sounds absurd to imagine the chaffinch saying to itself, well, I think this time I'm going to have a 4 second trill, so that means I've got to keep the song down to 1 second. Okay, that's getting too sophisticated, but the fact is that there is a primitive syntax going on in the chaffinch's song. The two parts of the song are not independent of each other. The length of time of one influences the length of time of the other. So there you can see a sort of very simple model as to how a syntax might arise, where two noises get put together that were in the case of our ancestors, early humans. Perhaps you start off with these two quite separate noises, but a custom arises of uttering them together, and then they start to influence each other in some way. So that, whereas in the case of the chaffinch's song, of course, it's only a very primitive syntax, and we as yet have no semantics. That's to say, we have no meaning. The chaffinch's song doesn't mean anything. In the case of primitive noises uttered by early humans, they would have had meaning. And then we can suppose that when they got fitted together and influenced each other, the meaning changes. So the meaning of the whole thing is affected by the meanings of the parts and is a new thing arising from the putting of those parts together. As I say, the crucial step is from two individual isolated noises to a conjunction of them. As soon as you've got a two-word sentence, no matter how simple, like come here or go away, and presumably the very earlier sentences were things like that, you've got syntax, you've got words which have a syntactic function and have their own kind of syntactic function. So if I can try and resume the thread which I've slightly diverged from there in discussing the chaffinch's song and the origin of syntax, the point that we were considering was whether Geech wouldn't have had a stronger argument if, instead of taking examples of isolated names from a fully formed language, so the language we speak now, a language at a late stage of historical development where you already have complete sentences. It seems, you know, it's then, if when Geech comes along and says, well, look, you know, you can utter single words like fire and poison. It's a very easy reply to say, well, look, yes, you can do that, but this usage of individual words, single words, is parasitic, as philosophers say, depends on the use of whole sentences. So they, in effect, these single words are just abbreviations of sentences which could be uttered, and sometimes are, but don't need to be because it's obvious from the context what they are. So if somebody shouts fire in a building, it's just obvious what that person is trying to say. You don't need to hear the whole sentence, there is a fire in the building. But that sentence is available if anyone misunderstands, and you can come out with it. So that Geech, as it were, you might say to him, look, you're shooting yourself in the foot if you use examples like that, because it's just easy to see that these single word things, examples that you're coming out with, abbreviate whole sentences that are there in the language anyway, in the background, ticking away, as it were, and can be wheeled out as and when necessary. So that if a child, say, doesn't understand the label poison on a bottle, you can explain it and you would then express a whole sentence in doing so. Surely, you might say to Geech, you would have been better off, if you want to challenge the context principle, thinking about early human beings, the origins of language, or indeed even things like bird calls, where there are no complete sentences, or there were no complete sentences at this early stage. There were just individual noises, and yet we do want to say that those individual noises have meaning, and that's something I've been conceding all along. If a bird utters a warning cry, that is a sign with meaning. If an early human being makes a threatening grunt to another one in order to chase that person away from a food source, say, then again, we want to be able to say, well, that's an act of communication. There's meaning going on there, some kind of linguistic meaning. Linguists use the term proto-language to refer to language in this very early stage that we're conjecturing. We don't have any examples of it, unfortunately. But we conjecture that language must have gone through such a phase of being proto-language at which only individual sounds were uttered before they were put together into sentences. And so you might say, well, look, surely the strongest argument against Bentham is to focus on that kind of case and say, well, these individual sounds have got meaning, but ex hypothesi, there is no background sentence that, as it were, is ticking away in the background. And if somebody misunderstands, then another speaker can come out with that sentence. Right. So if I'm an early man and I grunt at you threateningly and you don't understand, what do I do? Well, there isn't a language yet. There are only grunts and noises like that, so I can't come out with a sentence. All I can do is make the grunt louder and, you know, shake my fist at you, throw a spear at you or something to make it clear that I want you to go away, or whatever it is that I'm trying to communicate. So you might say, well, surely that's quite a favourable case for Geech. Don't we here have individual sounds that really do have meaning? They're not, perhaps, names. That's not a very natural way to describe them, you might say. But they are signs with meaning of some sort. Okay, well, that's one way in which you might try and shore up Geech's objection to the context principle, but you may be able to anticipate, or have been able to anticipate, my reply to that, because I do have a reply, which is that, and this may seem a bit like cheating, we're going to have to say a little bit about this, because this does introduce a a difficult point. But my reply is, well, actually, I go on saying the same thing, namely, that in these cases of utterance of a single sound, there is indeed a sentence in the background which expresses what that sound means. So in the case of a grunt, in my earlier example, the sentence might be, go away. This is mine, another sentence, if I'm defending a food source that I've found. That the sentences like that are indeed in the background and are necessarily in the background if the grunts are to have meaning. So the grunts do presuppose complete sentences. That's my response. And of course, the obvious comeback there is to say, well, the sentences weren't around at the time. I mean, you're expressing them now in English in the 21st century. But those sentences weren't around at the time. And the grunts themselves couldn't be strung together into sentences. We haven't got that far yet in the development of language. So that's why I wondered whether you might think that this was kind of cheating to defend the context principle in this way and say, well, yeah, these grunts, these individual grunts do have meaning, but they do actually presuppose complete sentences, and they have to in order to have meaning. They depend on that. And I do indeed want to say that. If you couldn't spell out in complete sentences what these noises meant, then I wouldn't want to say that they have semantic meaning, that they have linguistic meaning of any sort. Their having meaning depends upon the ability to spell out in a complete sentence what they mean. And we can do that. And now I'll say that again by shifting the emphasis slightly. Their having meaning depends on our ability to spell out in complete sentences what they mean. And we can do that. That's what I said. And now re-emphasize that as, and we can do that. They can't. By hypothesis, these early people don't yet have complete sentences. So they can't spell out what they mean in a complete sentence when they utter these grunts. And the same, of course, goes for bird calls. When birds utter their warning cries, they can't express in complete sentences what they mean. But we can. I can. Right? So the requirement set by the context principle must be expressed cautiously. The context principle shouldn't be taken to imply that for anyone or any creature, or indeed a machine, that utters something which has semantic meaning, utters an isolated noise, the context principle shouldn't be taken to imply that that very thing itself, that person or that machine or that animal, can itself form the background sentence or a background sentence that is presupposed to the meaningfulness of this individual sound. No, a bird can't do it. A human infant at a stage before it's learnt language can't do it. And our human ancestors couldn't do it at the stage of language development that we're hypothesizing here before sentences came along. So they didn't have complete sentences at their disposal. But nevertheless, it can be done by somebody, right? It is possible for a sentence to be formed in some language or other which expresses the meaning of one of these individual grunts. And as I say, this has to be because there weren't any full languages around at this early stage that we're talking about, there were only these grunts, then the language in which we formulate these sentences necessarily has to be a modern language. So the point is that the meaning of one of these individual sounds, for it to have that meaning, it has to be possible for that meaning to be expressed in a sentence of a fully formed language. But if we're talking about the grunts made by our early ancestors, when, by hypothesis, there were no fully formed languages, then necessarily the sentence that is used to express what that grunt, what a particular grunt means, has to be a sentence of a language that has only arrived on the scene since then. But nevertheless, you can, it seems to me that that is legitimate. You know, it's a similar point to the fact that you can describe how the world was before language came along, before human beings came along. You know, we can and we do describe in science, when we do science, how the world was, how the universe was, at a stage long before there were any creatures around to talk about the world. And we necessarily use our own language, the language we have here and now, but we don't think that that disqualifies it. We don't think that that means it can't apply to a time before there was language. Okay, so if I say something like, human beings evolved from simpler organisms. I've said that in English. And the fact that that process occurred at a time when English did not exist, when no language existed, doesn't somehow mean that what I've said is wrong. It's a true sentence, we believe. Or at any rate, it's a meaningful sentence, and that's the main point. We can talk meaningfully about a time and a place, remote parts of the universe, where and when language does not exist. That's a very extraordinary and striking fact. It's what philosophers call a transcendentalist point. What does that mean? Well, a transcendental condition is a condition that makes something possible rather than an empirical precondition. So when I say that I'm making a transcendentalist point, the way that works out in the present instance is that I'm making a point about, or rather I'm claiming that the context principle is making a transcendentalist point. It is trying to specify a condition of meaning in principle. So for a word to have meaning, the way I've been putting it, you know, in the last few minutes has been something like, for a word or an individual sound to have meaning, there has to be a background sentence expressing that meaning. And I've been allowing that this sentence can be of any language at all, so a language which isn't on the scene when the individual word is that we're thinking about is uttered. It just has to be expressible in some language at some time. So similarly, I mean, a simpler example is the remote space example. You know, we take ourselves to be able to describe remote places in the universe and remote times, as we've been discussing. So we take ourselves to be able to talk about what, you know, I mean, we don't need to, you know, what distant stars are like, what's going on there, what distant planets. We're discovering new planets all the time. We're finding out things about these planets. Many of them are enormous distances from us. And yet the information we're receiving from them enables us to say certain things about them. And we take ourselves to be able to say these things and to utter true sentences about these remote parts of the universe. Even though there's nothing like language, we suppose, going on there. Well, of course, there might be. That's what we're trying. Partly what we're trying to find out. But let's take a sort of example closer to home, let's take one of the planets in our solar system, like Jupiter. We know there's no language going on there. We're pretty sure there's nothing like language going on there. But that doesn't disqualify us, sitting here on Earth, from talking about Jupiter and saying true things about it. And as I say, the same point goes for remote times as well. So we can talk about times long before anything like language came on the scene. And that's what I was saying earlier was a rather extraordinary point. And that is the transcendentalist point. And we can push this transcendentalist point a little bit further by imagining a scenario in which, and this could easily have happened, human beings did evolve, they started to develop language, they got as far as uttering grunts, single cries to each other. And then, unfortunately, there was an asteroid strike, just as we believe there was at an earlier stage, which wiped out the dinosaurs. Maybe there might have been another one. And the effect of this hypothesized strike was to destroy all life on Earth. So that human development was arrested at a point before sentences could come on the scene. They just got as far as individual noises like bird calls. So we wouldn't be around today. Nevertheless, we can imagine that counterfactual scenario and we can say that those grunts would have had meaning, and those meanings could be spelt out in complete sentences. Of course, we, in the counterfactual scenario, we wouldn't have been around to express those meanings, and we can sort of bring it to a point by saying, well, maybe nobody in the entire universe was around. Let's just suppose that we are the only intelligent life form in the universe. And now let's, in addition to that, suppose my counterfactual scenario of an asteroid strike, which stops all human life at a stage before language develops into sentences, forming sentences. Nevertheless, looking at it from a sort of bird's eye, God's eye perspective, if you like, we can say something like, in that counterfactual scenario, even though there would have been no creatures at all in the entire history of the universe with fully formed language, no creatures capable of uttering whole sentences, we've only got this as a relatively brief stretch of history in which human beings are starting to utter one-word cries to each other. Nevertheless, we, as it were, sitting in our armchairs as philosophers, can say, in that counterfactual scenario, those grunts would have had meanings. Those meanings are, in principle, expressible in sentences. It's just that nobody would have been around ever, anywhere, to express them in the counterfactual scenario. But as things are, we are around, and we can express them. But if we hadn't been around, they would still have been expressible. Right? This is a transcendentalist point coming in. The transcendentalist point is a point about possibility. What has to be the case for something else to be possible. And what I'm saying is, for these individual cries to have meaning, it has to be the case that they are expressible in sentences. Even if there never exists an actual empirical language, like English or German, in which those sentences can be uttered. Nevertheless, the possibility remains of developing a language and forming sentences and expressing the content of those grunts in those sentences. So what I've been doing here is I've been developing a sort of defense of what you might call an extended version of the context principle. The context principle says that a word only has meaning in the context of a sentence. We considered Geech's objection, and I then suggested, well, I suggested that Geech's objection doesn't work, but I then suggested he could have maybe put his objection in a stronger form by considering one word, single words or signs or utterances of some sort that we want to say, we want to allow to have meaning, but which are uttered in situations where there are no sentences, no sentences of an empirical language, of a real language that actually is spoken, because those have not yet developed. So maybe Geech's point would have been stronger if he'd said, well, look, the single utterances of our early ancestors had meaning, even though there were no sentences around at that time. So doesn't that make the context principle false? And my riposte to that has been, we have to transcendentalize the context principle, and we have to say, well, no, the context principle still obtains. It's still the case that these grunts only have meaning in virtue of possible sentences that would express that meaning. There aren't any actual sentences around, by hypothesis, when these grunts were uttered, but it is in principle possible for sentences to be expressed of some language or other, and these sentences would convey the meanings of those individual grunts. So they're having meaning depends on this possibility of fully formed sentences conveying their meaning. So the context principle, in my view, survives that kind of objection, but it has to go transcendental. It has to take a slightly subtler form, in other words, from the simple form, which wouldn't allow there to be individual utterances or noises that have meaning at a stage before language is sufficiently developed for speakers to produce sentences. Whereas I think I'm prepared to allow that. I don't want to say, well, bird calls don't have meaning because birds can't come out with complete sentences. Or our human ancestors' grunts didn't have meaning because they weren't able to come out with complete sentences. Meaning only came along when complete sentences came along. No, I'm prepared to allow that meaning comes along, as it were, independently of the actual existence of complete sentences in an actual spoken language, so long as the possibility exists of expressing the meaning of an individual noise, sound, sign in a sentence of some language or other, possibly a language that isn't on the scene yet, that hasn't been devised yet. Okay, that's more or less what I have to say about the context principle. There's one more point that I'd like to make. We're going to be saying more about the context principle and its significance in due course anyway, when we think about the principle of compositionality. But here's one parting thought about the significance of the context principle. And this is why one reason why I think it's such a deep principle, and also very puzzling philosophically. I mean, it seems to me, on the one hand, the context principle is simply ungainsayable. It seems to me that when you develop it in that transcendentalist way, it's got to be right that words are essentially components of complete sentences, whether the sentences actually exist or only exist abstractly as possibilities. So the word gets its whole functionality from its role in a sentence. That seems to me right. But one consequence is that if it's right, there must be a sense in which reality itself, the world itself, is structured by language, is formed by language. Because, I mean, let's go back to the philosopher's favourite sentence, "The cat is on the mat." There you have a sentence. Let's say that it's true in some context, right? The cat is actually sitting on the mat. Well, you've got all those words making up that sentence. The sentence is true. Reality really is like that. There really is a cat on the mat. You know, one wants to say that the sentence is adequate. It's not somehow falling short of the reality. It's not, of course, describing reality completely, but far from it. It's describing only a little bit of reality. But as far as it goes, it seems to be an adequate instrument for saying how things are. If I say the cat is on the mat, or you'll find that book in the next room, there isn't any sense in which there's some kind of unbridgeable gap between language and reality, which somehow makes what I say, well, what exactly? Not true? No, it is true. The book really is in the next room. The cat really is on the mat. Even if it's false, I still seem to be engaging with the world. I'm talking about, at any rate, a possible state of affairs. So, on the one hand, I think we're strongly inclined to think, and it seems to me it must be right to say, that language is adequate to describe reality. But how can that be if words are essentially syntactic objects? This is the puzzle. If words get their function from their role in sentences, they essentially have relations with other words. So, you know, a verb or a noun is defined by the way it interacts with other sorts of word. An adverb is a kind of word that qualifies a verb or an adjective or another adverb. So these syntactic functions that words have are essentially ways in which they interact with each other to form meaningful sentences. And then these meaningful sentences are capable of describing the world. And that seems very odd, because it's as though we've invented a whole lot of rules about how words go together. And those rules don't seem to bear any relation to reality. They're rules about words and which words can be put together with which sorts of words. And it doesn't seem as though there's any constraint operating from the side of the world on that process. It's as though we're inventing the rules of a game like chess. We can make up the rules as we like. And yet we then find that this game, what Wittgenstein calls the language game, has application to a world, the world, that it can say true and false things about the world. And how on earth does it manage to do that? I mean, how can it be the case that by devising a game with words in which I say, well, you know, you can put a noun together with a verb to make up a sentence. So you can say, John swims, or Jane is hungry, right? You can have you can form simple sentences in this way. But if you try and put a verb together with a verb, you just get nonsense. So, is hungry swims, that's not an allowable move in the game. Similarly, John Jane, that hasn't been allowed for either. I haven't devised a rule for that. I've only devised a rule for how do you put a noun together with a verb to form a simple sentence. So we've got this game, we've got these rules which allow you to do certain things and disallow certain other things. So it's a bit like chess so far, right? The bishop can move diagonally, the rook can move in straight lines, not the other way round. Okay, we could devise the rules differently, but this is how we're setting them up. And then, lo and behold, all of a sudden, these sentences that we form, which are allowed by the rules of the game, have truth values, right? So, and that, you know, we want to say that the true ones actually describe reality as it is. It's a fact that the cat is on the mat. You know, Jane really is hungry. That's a piece of the world as it were. It's more than a game. So it's as if, it's just as if, you can get the sense of the puzzlement, I think, if you take the chess analogy, and it's just as if we suddenly found an application for chess in the sense that we were able to interpret chess positions as statements about the world. And that we found that, and we suddenly found that these statements were useful in science, that they enabled us to derive things which we wanted to regard as true. They were helpful in the way that applied mathematics is helpful in science. You know, it would be as if chess had an application in science in that way. Even though it was originally devised as a game and the rules were entirely arbitrary, they were just made up. They could have been, you know, they were just made up by the game's inventors. They could have been devised in a different way. The rules weren't devised by reference to any state of the world. They weren't copied from anything in the world. You know, the inventors of chess didn't say the rook has to move in straight lines because that corresponds to the way castles in the world actually behave. No, that's nonsense. The rook represents a castle, but the inventors of the game could have given it any set of moves they wanted. So the rules of the game are arbitrary. They're not based on anything in the world. They're not answerable to anything in the world. So it would be extraordinary if we suddenly found that chess positions and chess deductions, theorems of chess, could be used by real science to talk about the world. And the puzzle that I'm finishing with, well, I'm taking rather a long time to finish, is it seems as though something similar is going on with language. Isn't it the same as chess in the sense that you have a bunch of words, you have syntax which tells you how to combine these words. So it's a set of rules of the game. And one rule of the game is, you know, you can put Jane together with is hungry to get a sentence, but you can't put swims together with is hungry to get a sentence. That's just one of the rules of the game. I mean, that's how we've devised it. And then we find that thing which I said would be extraordinary in the case of chess, namely that when you put Jane together with is hungry, you get a sentence which actually describes a piece of the world, tells you something true or maybe false, but even if it's false, it's still describing a piece of the world, a possible state of affairs. It's got application. Language has application to the world. That's the puzzle, really. And the context principle raises that puzzle, in a particularly acute form, because the context principle stresses to us that words are syntactic objects. That's to say, they have combinatorial properties with other words, going along with other words. There are ways in which they can be combined with other words that are allowed for by the rules, and there are other ways that are disallowed. And, you know, if it's like the chess case, then those rules are arbitrary. They can be set up in any way at all. And yet, if that is the way things are, it's then very puzzling that sentences can be true or false, that they can actually have an application to the world, because the way they were set up was not beholden to the world in any way, it would seem, if the chess analogy is right. I mean, that's a big if, and this is going to be a problem that we'll have to think about again. But if the rules of syntax are arbitrary, then it is very puzzling that you can use combinations of words to utter true or false sentences. That you can, as it were, cross the bridge, cross the gap between language and the world. Okay, so I'll stop there. And next time I'll come to the principle of compositionality and how that relates to the context principle.